Accession number 28626, Real 2.
They are the eyes and ears. They are an extremely valuable asset. And I say this, I was the last Ring Platoon commander, because the infantry in its wisdom, or the army in its wisdom, felt that the infantry didn't need Wrecking Platoons. Well, it transpired that in 1983, I reformed the Wrecking Platoon for the infantry. I went to Warminster, I wrote a pamphlet on it, and having reformed it and run a cadre, the cadre that I produced in 83 for the Air Mobile Wrecking Platoon was used by the School of Infantry from then on, with it's been adapted now, but it was used as the model to teach all future reconnaissance platoon lance corporals, corporals, sergeants and officers what they should be doing. So I felt hugely sort of, not smug is the wrong word, but I commanded the last Wrecking Platoon, which I knew was always looked upon by soldiers as sort of, well, Wrecking Platoon, well, they're all the senior boys, you know, Jesus, yeah, they know what they're doing. A bit like the Mortarmen and the anti-tank, the old Wombat and Combat lads, you know, these were guys, these were senior soldiers. You never got into the Wrecking Platoon or the Mortars or the anti-tank platoon with his Wombat and Combat as an 18-month-old jock. You had to have served 5 or 6 years before you'd even be considered, because these were serious skills, and they're not learned overnight. The system has changed a bit, and we've got away from combat and wombat. We've now got Milan, and another shoulder and vehicle launched weapon systems. We've still got the 81mm mortar, bloody good weapon system. And we now have Wrecking Platoons back again. Reconnaissance platoons, Wrecking Platoons, they are the eyes and ears of the battalion. And therefore, you've got to have soldiers with poacher skills. You've got to have a soldier that can given 30 seconds, can just disappear into a garden or a field, and you haven't a clue where they've gone. They've got to be in a position where they can do that, blend in, but be able to report what they can see without being seen. So, you know, it was a fairly daunting thing for me as a young officer to find that I had the Wrecking Platoon, because we'd been told about them at PCBC, and we'd heard about them at Sandhurst. But no sooner had we finished our tour in 78 than Wrecking Platoons per se did not exist in the infantry. They were written out, and they only came back in when the Gordons became the Air Mobile Brigade, 16 Air Mobile Brigade in Hamer. 6 Air Mobile Brigade in Hamer, from 83 to 87.
I was thinking when you were saying that, you know, when you were describing it, it must have been quite a responsibility, you know, to go out with this platoon, you know, as a young officer, you know, the age you were at. And
yeah, I mean, it was responsibility. I think any young officer, or any officer, any senior NCO, anybody, any soldier, we all have responsibilities, not just to ourselves per se, but just as importantly to your buddy, to your section, to your fire team, to your platoon. You've got to look after everybody. Anybody who operates as an individual is in the wrong job, because that's not what it's about. You've got to look after everybody. If you don't look after them, how on earth are they expected to look after you? And simple things like just watching them when they go to the loo, you know, to make sure that they're not being spied on by somebody else, cooking somebody's dinner because they happen to be on stag, making sure that their bash is in good order so the rain is getting in and wetting all their kit. It's looking after everybody else, not just thinking, well, I'm all right, the hell with the rest of you, because that's seriously unprofessional. And I used to get really pissed off if any of my jocks or any of my soldiers did not look after each other. And it's amazing how once they learnt that that's what it's about, the transformation in the way they operate, because they do get very, very close. I had a Wrecking Platoon, which I'm sure we'll come on to later on, in the 80s. We were incredibly close. You know, I had a small fire team. I had Private Soldier, Paul Robb. I had Sergeant McDonald, and I had Corporal Calamedi. We're all very close still, You know, and that's what it's about. We were all able to bring something to the party, and I relied on the three of them to give me the support that I had tried to give them, because I knew certain things in detail. Callum Eddy was brilliant with radios. Matt was just an outstanding senior NCO. And he had a real breadth of knowledge on many things, but his logistics were really good, and you know, which was great. And Paul Robb, just the most amazing old guy. He'd been bussed a couple of times, from sergeant to corporal and corporal to private and this and that. He was your poacher turned gamekeeper, just an absolute star. And I felt so privileged to have a fire team like that. But my fire team was mirrored by the other five that were there. They had sergeants and they had corporals in charge, and they all worked in the same way, and they all still get on. You know, and we have reunions now and again, and it's just amazing.
I was just meaning, like, with being out at the front, you know, being out there, first ones out, I felt that maybe, did you not feel that you were maybe more of a target than the ones who would be coming behind you?
Well, I think you can look at it that way, but I think if your operational skills are good enough, you should be able to get to where you're going without the enemy seeing it. And that was a thing I think that I tried to instill in the lads, that their job is sneaky beaky. We go out, yes, we might get dropped off by helicopter, but we're then going to walk for a kilometre or 2 kilometres or whatever with all our kit on board to last in a hole in the ground for 5 days, 10 days, 3 weeks, and everything gets carried in, and you know, it's taken out again. Once it's been you've eaten your tins, you flatten them, you put them in your thing, you take them away again. You crap in a plastic bag. You know, you don't get out of the hole. You're in there, so you've got to get on with these people. And we never had a problem. I was just so chuffed. There was never a breakdown in discipline within the fire teams of the Recce platoon that I had in the 80s. That Northern Ireland Recce platoon was different. It was Recce platoon in name only, because the task that we were doing on the street back in 77, 78 was the same as any of the other rifle platoons within the battalion. So we were what do you call it, re-rolled. Well, I wasn't, but the Recce platoon was re-rolled to do the patrolling that was necessary, the VCPs, vehicle checkpoints, was necessary.
Okay, and this, I know we're going between the two, but the course that you have been on in Warmminster, was it just for Northern Ireland, or was it for anywhere where the British Army would have been due at that particular time?
Anywhere in the world, I mean. Okay. Every single conceivable operational sphere, mountains, Arctic, jungle, Northwest Europe, Far East, Northern Ireland, 6 weeks of continual training in different areas. We did spend more time on mechanised and Northern Ireland, because those were the two big issues at the time. But we learned about jungle warfare, and that's quite interesting when you go out and source a plane. You imagine you're in the jungle, you're working in some copse with trees that are about, you know, you can't get your arms around, rather than, you know, vines and bamboo. But nonetheless, we understood the principles. We saw where we couldn't spend a lot of time doing it for real, because there was no piece of ground that was right. We would see films, and then we'd go through the theory of setting these things up. Not the theory, we'd go through the actual practical experience of setting these things up. But an awful lot of the British Army's training methods fit different bills. So you can use one thing in the jungle, and you can use the same thing in Northwest Europe. There are little things you tweak, but really, the principles are the same. And that's what's so good about it. It's straightforward, and that's when the drill is instilled, and you know instinctively what you should be doing now. And you should be doing this in half an hour's time, but you should be doing this in 6 days' time, you know, and so on. Don't get me wrong. Being a young officer, being a senior NCO, being a soldier, is not a blind leading the blind. It's not, oh, we only do it by drill, we do it by numbers. That's not the case. But you've been through it, you've rehearsed it, and therefore you've got some anticipation of what to expect. So if you are attacked, then at least you're going to do something about it. You're going to respond, hopefully in a positive way, but you're going to do something about it.
And you mentioned Salisbury Plain and Warmminster itself. Is that a big army area? Or was that a big army area then?
It was huge. Salisbury Plain itself, I don't know how many square miles it is, but we're talking hundreds of square miles. Southern part of the plain, we had the School of Infantry at Warminster. And then you were to the northern part of the plain and the central part, and you had all the gunners. And the gunners used to fire all their light guns and heavy guns into the plain, into these impact areas, which were basically, there were no go areas for the rest of the infantry, the rest of the trainees. And then on the eastern side of the plain, you had headquarters land. So, yes, I mean, it's a magnet, but it's not just, it's been a magnet for the British Army for centuries. There's always been fortifications on Salisbury. The Romans took an interest in it. The British Army have just continued that, adapted it and adopted it and made it work for them. Now, obviously, with the environmental pressures that are now on the Ministry of Defence these days, the army's presence around Salisbury Plain has been reduced. Warminster used to be, it used to have a demonstration battalion there, it used to have the platoon commander's battle course, it had the small arms school corps based there for all skill at arms work, it had the junior division of the staff course there, it had the squadron and company commander's course there, it had the commanding officer and SO1's course there, it had the mortar course at Netheravon, it had the anti-tank course at Netheravon. I mean, the number of things that went on Salisbury Plain, I'm surprised that they could fit it all the 365 days a year. It was staggering. I mean, the calendar, the operational calendar of usage on Salisbury Plain was, I mean, to put that together was a real achievement. And later on, when I went back to Warminster as an instructor on the platoon commander battle course, I was responsible for all the platoon commanders part in that, and I linked in with headquarters, School of Infantry, to make sure that we were not clashing with other people. And we built this thing, I mean, a year in advance. But it had to be, because obviously the civilian population were very long-suffering, were very good, but nowadays it's changed. A lot of the infantry side has now gone across the Wales, which is a bit more remote. And people accept that they can do a lot of the stuff now at based on Brecon. So that's where it's gone. All the junior NCOs are there, the officers, the commanders are there, company commanders' courses are there. It's just moved into Wales, basically, because there's too much pressure on Salisbury Plain. Not just from the military and with weapon systems improving, but actually from the environmental lobby. So it's the only option is to sort of restructure.
Okay, so were the local population, you know, quite okay about all these manoeuvres that might be going on, exercises?
I think that's a difficult question to actually answer, because there was so much going on. Now, any damage, obviously, the individual was recompensed appropriately, properly. But they actually quite enjoyed the military there, because there was money to be made. It was a wealthy, prosperous area, thanks to the fact there's a lot of military there. Now, a lot of the civilian population were quite happy with that, because their businesses thrived on that. There were a few, however, and I remember them vividly from my days as the directing staff coordinator, who were out and out against it. And at the end of the day, we decided that we could operate in a slightly different area, and therefore not impinge on their property every time. We didn't stop going there. We just said, for the next course, we're going to do it 400 yards away. But the course after that, we're doing it right back where we always did it. So there was give and take. Generally, I would say the population of Warminster of the Salisbury Plain, you know, be it Lark Hill, be it Warminster, be it Sutton Veney, Salisbury, all these areas were pro-military. It's my personal feeling. And I love them. They were great people.
Okay. And thinking of that period of time as well, was there any threat from the IRA there?
Definitely. Barracks were being targeted regularly. There were a number of successful operations mounted by Pyra, and soldiers were killed in their barracks. So yeah, it was very, very foremost in our daily life. You know, you didn't. I lived in a married quarter. You checked your car every morning. You put it in the garage. You took it. You checked it before you took it out to make sure there was nothing attached underneath it. Or if you'd been out overnight, you checked it. And that was a routine.
But was that still in this first period of time that you'd been there?
Yeah.
You were doing that, checking the car, and
yeah.
So there was. This
well, I didn't have a car when I was at Warminster the first time. I did when I went back there 18 months later, to the demonstration battalion. But yes, very much so, very much so.
Was there anything happened that first time you were there by the IRA or?
Well, there were things happening, but not in Salisbury Plain. Not generally that area.
And was it barracks that you were living in?
We lived in the school infantry. We lived in what they call the Harding's Mess, which is the platoon commander's mess. Very, very nice little mess. And we had a modern three-storey block with rooms, I suppose, a bit smaller than this room. So, you know, not a huge room, but you had in that, you had your bed, you had your desk, you had your wardrobe. So you could do all your work in there. And it was your room for the 11 weeks of the course, and there were communal loos and showers and baths and that stuff. You know, you shared, but each floor was the same. Three floors, quite comfy. Just next door to the sergeant's mess.
And when you inspected at this point, or
no,
you know, the room was kind of
yours. It was your room. The you'd had all the inspections. You were expected to be a responsible, capable young bloke. Sometimes the directing staff would come in if there had been complaints from the mess staff that there was something going on, then there would be a quick inspection, but it didn't normally go much further than that, to be honest.
And did you have anyone to help you as well, you know, to maybe clean your room or anything like that?
There were cleaners, but they did not clean your room. They cleaned the corridors, the loos, they made sure that was okay, because Once you go to PCBC, as it was then, your feet did not touch the ground. You were out for 14, 16 hours a day on an ordinary day, and when you were in exercise, you were out for 5 days, and you never got back in. So you can understand that when stuff came back in, it was filthy. It was heaving, and was washed down, hung out, good drying rooms, and it was dried, and away you went. And the nature of the weather was, back in 1977, that it was raining most of the time. So we were always doing it.
Okay then. And what about, was there any restrictions on you going out at that time? Or, you know, was it like, okay, you have said that sometimes you could be out for about 16 hours or you could be out for 5 days. But maybe on the days where it was more like an office job, were you allowed out at night, or was there restrictions?
Oh, yeah. No, we were treated as adults, and there's no question of this. We knew that we had to pass this course. It was an important course. Some of my colleagues perhaps didn't think that way, and they were out looking for lasses and, you know, drinking and stuff. But no, we did go out. Oh yeah, we did go out. We normally got Sunday off. Sunday, we weren't on exercise, and we weren't in the classroom, but we would have work to do. We have things to get ready for Monday morning, or things to write up, and so forth, or things to learn for various exams that we had to take. Progressive exams every 2 weeks. To make sure that we'd hoisted in what's been taught. But we had a perfectly good bar in the mess, which was, you know, cheaper booze. And we did tend to gather in the mess later on, probably about 10 o'clock at night, have a drink, have a bladder, and then go to bed. But those some guys went out all the time. God, yeah.
Okay, and so at the end of the course, did you have an exam, or were you being tested all the time? You know,
you were being assessed on every exercise and everything you did. You got command appointments. You might have been a platoon commander, you might have been a platoon sergeant, you might have been a corporal, section commander. You were being assessed the whole time on your command ability, but you were also being assessed on your theoretical knowledge of the subject. So there were written tests every 2 weeks, and these were big tests. I mean, I recall these being as big as anything I took at higher level, but you were doing this regularly, and it was actually quite fresh in your mind. You had to swat up, and we all did, And you know, we achieved different grades at the end of the day. For me, because I was eager, I was keen, and I enjoyed it, I actually did quite well. But some of the other lads who, you know, who'd been around a bit longer and weren't going to Northern Ireland and weren't quite so eager, well, they didn't do quite so well. But they perhaps did better in some of the command appointments. So it swings around the best. You know, because a command appointment, you just enter into the spirit of things and you do your best. But it's important when you're doing these things that the people who are working with you, the other commanders, the other, you know, platoon sergeants or corporals or whatever, who are all second lieutenants or lieutenants, pull their weight and support you. Because there's nothing worse than getting people who go, I'm not going to support you. That'll be noticed and they'll be written down. So every time you were in a command appointment, doesn't matter if it was a lance corporal's or you were the radio operator or whatever, you really did try. I can only recall a couple of folks who didn't, and they soon found out that they wasn't good enough, because they wouldn't accept it from their singular if he didn't bother. That's the nature of the course.
So was it the course did finish as well? Was that any more parades that you did, or was it just like the end of a course?
End of a course.
Okay.
Big piss up, big hooli, everybody left the next morning with sore heads. That's what happened.
How fast you've been on the course as well? Did you wear your uniform or was it civilian clothes?
Oh no, you wore nothing but combat, nothing else, just combat or PT kit. You're doing PT. The civilian clothes. If you went out, you weren't allowed to go out in military uniform. You went out in civilian clothes, jeans, a t-shirt, or whatever you wanted. But every day apart from Sundays, it was the green DBM.
Okay. So it came to the end of the course. What happened then?
We had our party. Next morning I got up and I went straight to Liverpool and got on a ferry to go to Northern Ireland.
Okay, and how were you feeling then, you know, about going to Northern Ireland?
A little apprehensive, because I think I was going to, you know, I was going to the town. And so, yeah, away you go. You know, and I hadn't, it had been 11 hard weeks and no... I'd had my 2 weeks leave before I started the course, but I was then required, so it was out of the frying pan into the fire, really.
And were you travelling in civilian clothes as well?
No, you travelled in civilian clothes, but I think anybody with any sense could look at a young officer with short hair and realise exactly what they were, and they're carrying a green duffel bag, you know, yeah, we know what you're doing. So, we had to report to military movement people, so we were, whilst you were vulnerable, you were... They had a higher state of alert, so you were brought into this, and then you were moved on in special areas, you know, either by ship or by chartered ship or by plane, and you were always met at fire end. So, they were taking sort of as much care of it, obviously, could.
Okay. So when you went to Liverpool, is this where you met the military movement, or was that once you got across to?
No. When you went to Liverpool, okay. you got the train up. I got the train up from Bristol. To crew and I transferred and went to Liverpool, and you made your way to the military movement's desk at Liverpool Docks, and then you were clocked in there. You were told to wait. There was a whole batch of people, and then you were just, you know, that's it. You were given a briefing, an up to date brief of what was happening across the water, and then you were all just marched on and sat down, sailed, and that was it. You arrived at the far end, you came off into military movements, and then you were put in a bus or met by your own battalion and just driven home.
Okay.
To you.
So to cross the water, were you in a military craft or were you just in a normal civilian one?
No, we were, on this occasion we were in a small ferry which the military had taken up because they were moving other things out there at the same time, other vehicles and stuff, so they'd taken up a small ferry for that particular thing. So they actually had quite a lot of people moving that day. I think there's something in the region of 200 soldiers and a number of vehicles.
And do you remember where about you landed?
We went to Belfast. Yeah, into Belfast.
So what was your first impressions of Belfast?
Well, when we arrived, it was actually getting dark, so I didn't actually... We went to Harland and Wolff, and it's a really great, huge thing with lights on it, but... I didn't, you know, we got off there, and I was met by one of the the duty, the Gordon Highlanders duty patrols, and they then drove me through Belfast and out to Palace Barracks, which is a good sort of 40 minutes away, really. It seemed like 40 minutes away.
And do you remember what you were thinking, you know, as you were getting driven out there?
No, I was just listening to what was being said. You know, I didn't have any preconceived thoughts. I just, you know, listen, this is it. Yeah. Let's get there. Got there. Had my dinner. And then I was, yeah, just thought I could relax, and I was to report to the adjutant next morning, so that's what I did.
Okay. And whilst you were driving through Belfast, you know, was it very built up, or how did it look, you know?
Well, it was built up, and I was in the back of one of these pigs, so you don't, it's difficult to see too much. I mean, it's a city. You know, it was not being a city man, it seemed awfully busy, but no, it was just a built up place, and there was things going on, there was, the boys were always talking, you hear the radio crackling, so you know, you could hear things, but they were responding, they were listening to the net, so they knew what was going on in other areas, and no, it did seem, in the centre part, certainly from Harlan Wharf going into the town, there was a lot of activity going on, but then as we went out the south side, it seemed to quite an earlier.
I had thought when you said, you know, someone collected you, I just assumed that it would be a car.
No.
Hadn't thought it would be one of these vehicles.
The only people that operated cars were probably the sort of intelligence boys who were in plain clothes, who had long hair, you know, moustaches, earrings in, you know, these are soldiers who'd adopted the way of the locals, because that's what their job was. They were to try and get information from other means. Dangerous job. Whereas we were very much, you know, British soldier on the street with your green uniform on and your self-loading rifle. That was it.
Okay. Now, did you say it was Palace Barracks?
Yeah, that's right. Okay.
So what did it look like?
Well, I remember going in the gate, and you had you go up a ramp, I recall, and on your right-hand side was the guard room, and then at the top you then turned sharp right up past the sergeant's mess, and you drove up this long ramp, and at the top of which was the officer's mess. Behind the officer's mess you had the headquarters of the battalion, battalion headquarters, and then dotted around the square, which is above the officer's mess, you had these large company blocks. I was in C company block, which was diagonally across the square there. Behind that, there were quarters, married quarters. And then working your way along, there was an assault course, and then at the very sort of western side of the camp, there was a big football field. So it was quite a compact camp, but we had all the married quarters in there, and the company quarters, company blocks. I think in hindsight, it was quite a compact barracks, because I've been in barracks subsequently which are 20 times bigger.
Was it an old barracks?
I don't know. I would say the buildings were very smart. They were probably 1900 or thereabouts. So, but they were in fairly good nick. It was no, I would say it was no older than 100 years old, and obviously the married quarters were newer than that, but the original fabric of the build of the camp, I would say, was probably no older than 100, but I wouldn't want to be quoted on that, because I didn't actually go into the history of Palace Barracks.
And you mentioned married quarters as well. Were wives allowed across to Northern Ireland, wives and families?
I was there because we were on an 18 month accompanying tour. The boys who were on the four month tour, as they were then, they were unaccompanied. But anybody on an 18-month tour, what we were on, your family could accompany.
And was the whole regiment there?
The whole battalion was there, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And we had everything on site. There was shops on site. There was a plastic pub, we called it. A little pub. Plastic pub. There was a lovely Indian chap who did bacon butties. Huge highlight. You always come off patrol at night and you go straight into the charwalas for bacon butties. God, it was great. Nothing better.
Okay.
Yep.
I think on that note, I should finish this section.
Fine, okay.
Thank you.